Welcome to the Hurricane Center podcast, produced by the Storm Science Network and part of the National Tropical Weather Conference. This podcast is made possible by USAA, the South Padre Island Convention and Tourist Bureau, and Plylox Hurricane Clips.
Our speaker today has become a regular member of our team on the NTWC Live this summer, and lately we've been having him introduce the guest speaker, but I won't make him introduce himself. So Dr. Hal Needham is an extreme weather and disaster scientist. That's a cool title. For the past 17 years, he has worked with disaster-prone communities to make them more resilient from natural hazards. He runs the USURGE project, the subject he'll be talking about today, which provides the most comprehensive global data set for hurricane-generated storm surge, the world's most deadly and costliest natural disaster producer. He's also a lead scientist for flood information systems, where he builds technology to predict and assess flood impacts. And in recent years, he's created interactive video content and hosted a popular podcast on the topic of disasters and resiliency through Geotech. He lives just down the road from me in Galveston, has a front row seat for when the landfalls occur. And we were talking earlier today, one of the things I really appreciate that Hal does is the historical aspects of hurricane, and he's developed a nice side gig, if you will, of leading tours in the Galveston area and related those to what the impact of hurricanes has had on Galveston's history. So Hal, without further ado, take it away.
Thanks, Bill, for the warm introduction. Great to see everybody this morning. I'm going to share my screen here. Yeah, I'm here in Galveston, Texas. You know, it's funny. My neighbors have not cut their grass in like a month. I promise you, it's waist-high grass. And the landscaping crew just showed up, so you might hear some background noise that's out of my control this morning, but it's all good. We're going to have a good time this morning talking about storm surge and these different hazards that affect coastal areas as well. So, you know, we talked a little bit about Galveston. It was a very prosperous city in the late 1800s. It was one of the wealthiest cities per capita in the U.S. 122 years ago tomorrow, September 8th, 1900, Galveston was struck by a Category 4 hurricane that produced a 16-foot wall of water that washed over Galveston Island. These walls of water, we call them storm surges. It's basically saltwater flooding in a hurricane. It's the world's deadliest and costliest natural hazard. This is a picture of my neighborhood 122 years ago tomorrow. It was the deadliest natural disaster in U.S. history. About 6,000 to 8,000 lives lost in my community here in Galveston. Just a horrific event, so catastrophic. And it's something that's really been a part of the landscape here of overcoming and how do we defend against these big storm surge events. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about storm surge and what it really is. What do these saltwater floods look like? How do they react? How do they develop? What are the patterns and processes behind them? The goals of this presentation, we're going to learn what storm surge is and what are its impacts. We're going to learn about storm surge patterns and processes, and we're going to learn about storm surge psychology and how people evaluate risk using data from the USURGE project. So number one, what is storm surge and what are its impacts? I really love this graphic from the Australia Bureau of Meteorology. You can see on the left, these are normal conditions where we have low tide, high tide, mean sea level. But in a storm surge event, you have lower pressure and you have strong onshore winds. The entire column of seawater rises. And on top of that, you have large destructive waves. So really, the reason that the water rises, there are two reasons. The lower atmospheric pressure near the eye of a hurricane, you basically have less atmosphere pushing down on the water. And so we call that the inverse barometer effect. The lower the pressure, the more the seawater can rise. It basically rises in a dome or a bulge along the coast as it pushes in. Then secondly, we have strong onshore winds really pushing this water rapidly towards the coast. If you think about it, a storm surge has to flow because we're moving salt water onto normally dry ground. So it has to have a lot of very rapid flow. And that's why I put the arrows on this diagram. A lot of people picture storm surges as vertical water rising, but a lot of times they don't really picture the incredibly rapid flow and the wave action that's so destructive. Here's some pictures I took from field work in recent years. This is near, this is actually in Mexico Beach right after Hurricane Michael in 2018. They had a 14-foot storm surge with huge waves on top. This big blue building was torn in two and thrown into this condo. Imagine the force that it took to do that. The port just looked completely chaotic, just complete devastation there in the port of Mexico Beach after Hurricane Michael in 2018. I drove this area the day before Michael made landfall. There were beachfront mansions all along the coast, these big beach houses with a beautiful road. Well, the storm surge just completely chewed up the road, and the big beach houses are completely gone without a trace. You can see some of the slabs left behind, but a lot of these homes are completely gone from the force of the water. This is a before and after picture of El Governor Hotel in Mexico Beach. The before picture, that's my backpack and my laptop the day before landfall. The Weather Channel's on the TV. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. The bottom picture, my feet are in the same spot 3 days later. And the storm surge just completely gutted this entire building. The force of water, I mean, think of how heavy it is to carry a gallon of water upstairs and now bring billions or trillions of gallons in on these storm surge events. They're just pounding the coastal infrastructure. It can really be really tremendous, and a lot of big impacts there along the coast. This is a photograph of Tropical Storm Cristobal in 2020. You can see there's some pop, there's some energy to the wave action, but I thought it would be even better to show some videos here. So I'm going to try this out and see how it works. I wanted to share some videos. I guess you could say a storm chaser. Maybe you could call me a surge chaser. I'm really interested to document storm surge. Let's look through some of these videos from recent years. Again, this is Cristobal in 2020. This is a low-end tropical storm making landfall in Louisiana, and I'm in Mississippi. So I'm detached from the landfall location. The winds were maybe 40 or 45 sustained over by the eye, and you could see how much water, just the flow and the rapid action of the water offset from the storm center on a weak tropical storm. Imagine if this was a landfalling hurricane in the same spot. You could just get an idea of really the water action there. This is moving out in the same storm, more on the open road there, that beach road. I think it's Highway 90 along coastal Mississippi. You can see a lot of wave action. The water's pushing in past the palm trees and the street signs too. This is, so a lot of people, I think, overemphasize the concept of the inverse barometer effect, that you have this dome of water from the lower pressure. That does contribute to surge. But from what I've read and studied and from my field work on the ground, I really think it's the wind that just pushes in the surge incredibly fast. This is in Hurricane Delta in South Louisiana, 2020. I'm in Delcom. And you can see the wind just blowing very strong from right to left. And it's just pushing this water in rapidly up this canal. But it basically makes that canal look like a river or a stream. Very low frequency, high speed waves. I'm sorry, high frequency waves with low amplitudes. If you were to measure the wave crest, you probably have a wave crest passing a point more than once per second. So you can see how quickly it's moving in. When I first started looking at storm surge, it looked different than I expected. I pictured these huge waves rolling in. A lot of times it's very high frequency, low waves that are moving in more like a river or a stream that just start moving in quickly and inundate the dry ground. This is also Hurricane Delta in South Louisiana. Water's flowing from left to right. To give you context, I'm looking to the west. Vermilion Bay is off to my left. Behind me is the Delcom Canal. You can see there is some water flow there from left to right. Look over here on the right of the screen. You'll see that there's a road that actually remains dry. It's a little bit higher. And this is important. I like to get into these places at least 24 or 30 hours before landfall. I like to really know the terrain. I don't like to drive around unfamiliar roads at night in a hurricane. I got to know this area pretty well, and I saw that this road was higher. So that explains this next video, which starts down here, and it's going to be looking on the north side of the road where you don't have as much flow. And I want to show some things about this video. This is also in Delcom, Louisiana, Hurricane Delta 2020. This is on the north side of that road away from Vermilion Bay. And do you notice something? We don't see as much flow. We don't see waves with white caps. It looks pretty calm here, just like water rising vertically. And I want to, that's a big point to this video, that sometimes these velocity zones where you see the wave action, it can change from a velocity zone to more still water very quickly in a very short amount of space. You can see there is flooding. This is storm surge, but again, not a lot of wave action on the north end of this road. I'm going to fast forward here along the fence. Not a lot of wave action. It's just the water's pretty still. I drive down here towards some buildings. I get over here by the Delcom Canal. And now here's where you start to see some white water. Again, the surge is coming up quickly in the canal. There's a shrimp boat. I'm here all by myself. You can start to see some white water pushing in on the canal. That's pretty normal that the surge comes in on the canals. There you can see more white water. Now I'm looking towards Vermilion Bay. I'm just on the other side of the same road, and all of a sudden you see wave action. They're not huge waves, but we do see white caps nonetheless. You don't need big waves to start to tear apart a house. And so when you designate flood maps, like FEMA will designate areas as velocity zones or V zones. If you're in a V zone, that can change your risk. That can change your insurance rate. That can even change how we designate your first floor elevation. And so you can see, again, water flowing from left to right. You can see some white caps in there. I'm going to drive down this road. But again, you know, quite different conditions than on the other side of the road. As you can see, not huge waves, but again, pretty high frequency. They're moving in quickly. This is Hurricane Delta in South Louisiana in 2020. The water's coming in from the Vermilion Bay area. And I want to point something out here. I'm going to pause the video in a second. So again, this would be considered velocity zone. We can see some white cap waves. And actually, your first floor is designated differently if you're in a velocity zone. It's actually the lowest elevation of the lowest horizontal elevated, lowest horizontal structural member. So if you have like beams or boards on the bottom of your deck, they're taking the elevation of the lowest horizontal member there for your first floor elevation, as opposed to your floorboards if you were not in a velocity zone. So that can change how we determine your first floor elevation. And again, it can change how we determine your risk and also the power of the water to destroy your home. Lastly, I'm going to go over to this last house. Again, this is Hurricane Delta. You can see, though, you see the white water that you're not seeing on the other side of the road. So my point there is that storm surge conditions can be quite localized in these settings. So really interesting footage there. The last footage I want to show you, also from 2020, Hurricane Sally. You can see the water flowing from left to right across the road here in Dauphin Island, Alabama. Look at this. Over here by this palm tree, it's not dry. The ground's wet, but it's not inundated. Here we have inundation. Imagine if you're driving through here at night, you're not familiar with the area, it's dark, you can't see, and there's maybe 2 more feet of storm surge. These low areas like here where the water wants to flow through could really sweep your car off the road. Again, I'm here in daytime. I'm getting to these areas very early on, so I know the lay of the land. Again, I don't want to encourage people to drive around hurricane zones through storm surge. If you're in unfamiliar roads, you could get into a lot of danger really quickly. So that's explains a little bit of how I document these storms. I'm very careful with it. I'm definitely not a huge risk taker, and the footage of these may look more dangerous than it really is. The second thing I wanted to point out after my disclaimer there of how I chase hurricanes is that I'm also a trained stuntman. So if you check out my book called Stuntman Hal Needham, My Car Crashing, Plane Jumping, Bone Breaking, Death Defying Hollywood Life, Arnold Schwarzenegger actually mentioned incredible stories told by a real man of action. He called me a real man of action. So I'm trained. I know what I'm doing. It's a little bit of a joke here. If you do a web search for Hal Needham Stuntman, actually one of the world's most prolific stuntmen of all time has my same name of Hal Needham. I think he's been in like 250 Hollywood movies. And a funny story, when I did my first hurricane movie with PBS, they added me to the list of this guy's 250 Hollywood movies in the IMDb movie database. And so for like a month of my life, it looked like I had this amazing Hollywood career, and now I got into Hurricane stuff. And there, it was like the golden month of my life. I was popular. I had a date every weekend. And then they figured out, hang on, this is a different guy. So I this actually isn't me. It's a different guy by the same name. But just wanted to throw that disclaimer out there. We're talking about the pop to these waves, the energy of these storm surges. Here in Galveston, we have a massive seawall that was built after the 1900 storm. Water can flow over that seawall, but it's breaking a lot of this energy from these waves. This is a photograph of the Hotel Galvez, now called the Grand Galvez Hotel. It was built in 1911. This photograph's from the 1915 hurricane. This is Hurricane Ike in 2008. Again, water's going over the seawall, but the wall is really taking a lot of that energy from those breaking waves. And so that's helping Galveston a lot. We got flooded really bad here from Hurricane Ike in 2008, but it was more like still water coming in from the harbor side. That wave energy was kind of broken on the seawall compared to, say, the Bolivar Peninsula just north of me, where there was just complete devastation. Just almost every building was gone without a trace. So my main point in this first part was just to talk about storm surge. It's a saltwater flood, but it's flowing in with a lot of energy and a lot of wave action, which makes it particularly destructive. Number two, what are these storm surge patterns and processes? So this is a schematic that I have from my master's degree. It's just a generalized diagram of a hurricane making landfall, the counterclockwise rotation in the northern hemisphere. We're going to see the area of maximum storm surge just to the right, or on the right edge of the eye where the eye wall is coming in. This is in metric because it was for my master's degree. But here I'm saying, you know, a small area of peak surge, and then the surge diminishes slowly to the right of the eye, and it diminishes more rapidly to the left of the eye. So typically you'll hear newscasters, weather forecasters say just to the right of the eye, or just to the right of the eye center is where we usually see the peak storm surge. That's a generalized description if we're along a broad open coast. However, when we look at actual historic maps, we see the patterns are very different than we might expect. This is the 1915 hurricane. Sometimes I call this the forgotten hurricane that hit southeast Louisiana in 1915. You can see the track. It was a major hurricane. I think it came in as a category 3. So according to that generalized schematic, we should expect the peak surge to be just to the right of landfall, pretty close to Grand Isle. What we actually see when we look at this old Army Corps map, these are some of the surge heights. In this area where we would generally expect the peak surge, water levels got to about 9 feet. In this whole area here, they never topped 10 feet. Look over here to the east of the Mississippi River. We have 12 feet, 11, 6, 11. And up here in Lake Pontchartrain, to the left of the storm track, we have a 13. So that's not even near the original landfall. And it's actually to the left of the storm track on the weak side of the storm, right? So what in the world is happening here? Maybe they made a mistake with this map, right? I want to show you they really did not make a mistake. These patterns get more complex than people realize. There are a couple things really driving these storm surge patterns. One is the offshore water depth or the bathymetry. Also have coastal shape and the coastal aspect or the direction of the beach. Let's talk a little bit about this bathymetry or this water depth. When we're at the coast and we look out at the ocean, it just looks flat to us. We don't really see as humans what's going on underneath. But the bathymetry or the water depth changes dramatically depending where you're located. Look at this map of Florida. You can see the west coast of Florida has this really relatively shallow bathymetry. In the Florida Keys, the water's pretty shallow here on the west coast. Look over here in the southeast part of Florida, from Fort Lauderdale down to Miami. The water gets very deep very quickly. So a landfalling hurricane on those two coasts is going to look very different. I did this exercise where I went to Google Earth. I went 10 miles east of Miami, Miami Beach, and I found at 10 miles east, the water depth down here, it's 991 feet deep. It's nearly 1,000 feet deep, 10 miles off the coast. Compare that to coastal Mississippi. I went 10 miles off the coast of Gulfport. This is the Mississippi Sound. There are actually some small barrier islands out here. I go 10 miles off the Mississippi coast. Instead of 1,000 feet, my water depth is 12 feet. It's incredibly shallow if you're there in coastal Mississippi. So when we have these shallow, like these these shallow deltas and these very shallow areas, what we see is that the storm surge is really high and it can go inland for really far distances, sometimes as much as 30 miles or more. The waves, the kind of waves that surfers ride, tend to be smaller and they break very frequently. Compare that to a place like Hawaii or a lot of the islands in the Caribbean where you have this really deep bathymetry, really deep water depth. Your storm surge is not that high. You get a lot of wave run up from the wave action, but look at these waves. You know, you take a storm like Hurricane Iniki, hit Kauai, Hawaii as a category 4, the storm surge was only 6 feet. But the waves were like 40, 50 feet or higher. So you get these really huge waves coming in, but the storm surge itself tends to be lower where you have the deep bathymetry. I did a little field work last week in coastal Mississippi just to test this out. Friday evening, I had a long week. I thought I want to get out there for a saltwater swim. And so I was curious, how far do I have to go offshore to get waist deep water? And I actually did it. I walked offshore in Bay St. Louis, and I think I got about 175 or 200 yards before I got to waist-deep water. It's just that shallow if you're there in coastal Mississippi. You know, something about Mississippi, I love doing field work there, but I have to say, although the people are friendly, sometimes they kind of harass you. You know, I was walking around the streets of Bay St. Louis last week talking about hurricanes, and this guy comes up to me. He's like, what do you know about hurricanes? He said, I've been in 61 hurricane eyes. Some guy, I think he said his name was Josh or something. I don't know who this. Okay, so this is Josh Morgerman. He moved recently to coastal Mississippi. A lot of you know and love Josh. He's been a regular at our National Tropical Weather Conference. We grabbed dinner last Thursday night in Bay St. Louis. He's set up in a really nice central position there where he can chase hurricanes, you know, very easily along the Gulf Coast and get to the Atlantic as well. So we were hanging out talking about hurricanes. He's over there in Bay St. Louis now in this area that has really some of the highest storm surge risk on Earth. Hurricane Katrina in the Bay St. Louis past Christiane area got to around 28 feet. It's the highest storm surge on record in the Western Hemisphere. So very vulnerable area there to storm surge. Let's talk a little bit about coastal shape as well. Bays, inlets, sounds, channels, areas where you have concave shaped coastlines, all of these things enhance storm surge. So it's a little counterintuitive, right? Throughout all recorded history, people like to settle on bays and inlets where we generally have protected water conditions. In a storm surge, it's upside down. And all of a sudden, the areas that are usually protected become the most dangerous. Let's talk a little bit about that. When you have a hurricane, for example, coming up the east coast of Florida, the counterclockwise flow, you're going to produce a really big storm surge in coastal Georgia, southern South Carolina, and northeastern Florida because it's very shallow, but you also have this concave shape. We've seen a few hurricanes do this, like Dorian kind of was in that area, Hurricane Matthew in 2016, Isaias. We've had a lot of storms like this where we see the surge really peaking up there along that concave area shaped coast. This was a National Hurricane Center search forecast for Hurricane Matthew in 2016. And even, you know, when it was way down here, they kind of knew, okay, the area of peak storm surge is going to be North Florida to southern parts of South Carolina. A lot of my friends in Georgia say, hey, we don't have a hurricane problem. The hurricanes always miss us. They always hit either the Florida Peninsula or they curve and they hit the Carolinas. We don't have a storm surge problem in Georgia. When you go back and you look in history, again, they don't have as many hits, but when they get a hit, the storm surge is through the roof. This is a picture of the damage from a 16-foot storm surge in 1898 in Brunswick, Georgia. We don't know when this will happen again, but I believe it will. And again, their storm surge risk is really high compared to other places. See this map of Hurricane Irma in 2017. Passed through the Florida Keys as a Cat 4, and then it was weakening as it moved up the Florida Peninsula. So on its closest approach to Miami, it was really like a Cat 4. Up here where we have higher storm surge, the storm surge here are these dots. Miami only had a 2 to 4 foot surge, even though on its closest approach, it was like a Cat 4. Look up here by the Georgia-Florida line right here. We're seeing a 6 to 8 foot surge, and at its closest approach, it was only a tropical storm. So you can really see these patterns playing out where you don't need a really strong hurricane to get a big flood up there by Jacksonville over to Tybee Island, Georgia. Let's look at some of these storms that have affected the Northeast, and we see some of these interesting patterns as well playing out with different sounds and inlets. This is the Great New England Hurricane of 1938. where really tremendous storm. We see the highest surge levels here. Anything in red is over 12 feet. Black is over 16 feet. Eastern New England, we see the highest water levels of all. But look to the left of the storm track, what we often call the weak side of the storm. Look at all of these red marks here, 12 to 16 foot storm surge piling up on the southwestern tip of Long Island Sound. This is getting into kind of the Bronx and some parts of Metro New York City. What's happening there? When you have the counterclockwise flow, eventually you start getting really strong winds blowing from east to west down Long Island Sound, and you get a localized maximum in there in Metro New York City, even though it's on the weak side of the storm. The surge doesn't care. It's saying, if you're going to push me into a pinch point, I'm going to really overflow into the land. And we see a similar thing here in 1954 with Hurricane Carol. Again, coming in here, we see a large area of surge in southeastern Massachusetts and Rhode Island. But again, we see a red dot showing up there near New York City. Again, we have the flow coming down Long Island Sound where we see a localized maximum. So these are just patterns that repeat again and again, where when we pinch water or we have it flow into a constricted area, the surge really goes up really high. Let's talk finally about the coastal aspect, the direction of the beach. So the aspect has to do with the direction. When you stand on the beach and you look at the water, what direction are you looking at? We also look for different shapes of the coastline. Looking here again at southeast Louisiana, coastal Mississippi, the coast kind of has this right angle to it. And so when you get a hurricane centered to the south of the Mississippi River Delta, and you have these prolonged east winds north of the center, you're just piling water up there along that right angle. And keep in mind as well, water wants to deflect to the right of the wind direction. It's something we call Ekman transport. It's related to the Coriolis effect. But when we have an east wind there, the water does not want to flow purely from right to left. It actually wants to angle off to the right of the wind. And so it's putting the water almost perfectly into that corner, where we also have really shallow bathymetry. Now we can see why Mississippi has some of the highest storm surges in the world. And I don't want to leave out our friends in southeast Louisiana, places like Shell Beach to the east of New Orleans. The storm surge risk is really huge there as well. Compare that to a place like Morgan City. Morgan City, if you're standing on the coast and you're looking out to the water, instead of looking to the south, you're looking to the southwest. But a prolonged east wind in Morgan City, when you have these hurricanes approaching from the south, it's actually blowing offshore instead of onshore. To get an onshore wind in Morgan City, you basically need a hurricane centered near Lake Charles, where the winds would come in from the southwest in Morgan City. Well, by then you're getting wraparound winds around the backside of the storm. The center of the hurricane is actually inland at this point, so it's weakening. You're just not really able to generate as high of a storm surge in a place like Morgan City. So let's look back to our map here where we saw these different patterns, and we can see what's happening here is we're getting a prolonged east wind, and it's just piling the water up on the eastern end of the Mississippi River levees, and also pushing a lot of water into here in Lake Pontchartrain, kind of like we see with Long Island Sound. It's a little different with Lake Pontchartrain, but it's still forcing the water into a basin where it really has no escape. Lake Pontchartrain also is pretty shallow. So we can see why we're starting to get these huge numbers here to the right of the river and in Lake Pontchartrain, and lower numbers here by Grand Isle. I mean, if you look at this, the water is flowing from right to left. The Mississippi River Delta is basically blocking a lot of this seawater from entering this area by Grand Isle. And then fishermen I know have said when they've been offshore from Grand Isle, the water actually gets deeper quicker. And so that's why Grand Isle, you have a relative minimum here where you're not seeing the huge surges that you are in the eastern end of the Mississippi River. I need to really take Hurricane Ida's map and compare this. I know I was up here during in La Place near Lake Pontchartrain during Ida. There was a lot of flooding and a lot of locals were shocked. They couldn't believe they were flooding. I wasn't that surprised because I've seen these historic maps where we get a real maximum there on the southwestern end of Lake Pontchartrain. This is the diagram that I photographed from my dissertation. It's showing the surge level in Hurricane Ike. So Hurricane Ike made landfall here in Galveston, city number 5. And again, we generalize the closer you get to the storm, the higher the surge levels. Well, look at this. City number 11, that's Shell Beach, Louisiana, just east of New Orleans. Your surge is about 1 meter higher, about 3 feet higher than it is down here by Grand Isle. And it's about, I would say, about 2 feet higher than it is in Morgan City. Morgan City is a lot closer to the point of landfall, than Shell Beach is. But Shell Beach actually got the higher surge. So again, this generalization that the farther you get from the storm, the lower your surge, it's not always true. People really underestimate the effect of the coastal profile and the coastal shape. That's driving a lot of these surge patterns, and a lot of people get blindsided by that. So the final thing I want to talk about is storm surge psychology and how people evaluate risk using data from USURGE that we're building. Again, this is a global storm surge database. I've been working on this for 14 years now. We're taking data from tide gauges, National Hurricane Center reports since 1958. These old U.S. Army Corps maps go back as far as 1886. I read like 3,000 pages of historic newspaper just in my master's degree. We have high water marks all along the Gulf and the Atlantic coast. And then photographs are very important. That's a picture of the Great Miami Hurricane from 1926, where the tops of the palm trees were sticking out. Can you imagine if that same thing happened today? It'd be, I think, hundreds of billions of dollars of losses. With USURGE, I started by taking the location and the height of the peak surge along the Gulf Coast. Every circle on this map is a peak surge location. The darker colored circles are higher surges. So everything in red is higher than 13 feet. Everything in purple higher than 16 and a half. And there's a geography to it. You see a lot of red and purple along the northern and western Gulf Coast and in extreme South Florida and the Florida Keys. Look at the west coast of Florida, though. You don't see any red. You don't see any purple. We don't have anything observed higher than 13 feet in western Florida since. And I should clarify this. This original map was since 1880. I've made it to 1837 because of a Galveston observation I have. Tampa did get two big surges in 1848. One was 10 feet and one was 14. So as I add those data, we'll actually get a red dot there in Tampa from 1848. But generally speaking, the west coast of Florida has been very fortunate. They would need a strong hurricane approaching from the southwest. The model suggests we could see a 20-foot storm surge in Tampa Bay. It's just less likely than a place like Gulfport, Mississippi, or say Galveston or Port Lavaca, Texas. A limitation of this is that every dot on this map is just the peak location for a given surge. I expanded it, though, along the Atlantic and the Caribbean, Central America. I built the first database I know of for Bangladesh and India. These are the highest surges in the world. They reached as high as 44 feet, if you can believe it. And then also in Asia, I worked with Pagasa. That's like NOAA for the Philippines. We built their first storm surge database. And Australia, I think I have high watermarks for 127 tropical cyclones since around 1900 for Australia. I have to add a few observations I've recently put in from South Korea, where we saw about a 1 meter surge this last week, about 3.3 feet near Busan in southeastern South Korea. I've expanded this work after I did the peak surge database to take a storm and map out all of the high water marks for all of the storms. So this is Hurricane Katrina, for example. Everything in black there was a surge level higher than 16 feet. You can see the entire Mississippi coast had at least a 16-foot storm surge. So very devastating storm. Once I had all of these layers of all the high water marks, I could overlay them and start to drill down into any location and start to see the history. So this, for example, is a project I was recently funded on in Biloxi, Mississippi. I have high watermarks for 35 hurricanes and tropical storms since the late 1800s. You can see Camille and Katrina really stand out. Camille is here in 69. Katrina really stands out. And what we can do is actually strip out the sea level rise and just say, how much water did each of these storms push above the sea level for the year of the storm? Katrina really stands out. This is called a histogram, this kind of graph. Typically, for most coastal locations, the highest one or two storms are much higher than all the others. That's similar for Biloxi. Corpus Christi is interesting. I think this is a 10-mile radius covering Corpus Christi Bay. We see a lot of activity there in Corpus, especially in the middle part of the 20th century. But it's been really quiet since 1980, Hurricane Allen. So imagine if someone in Corpus built a house, low elevation, 7 feet, in 1982. They might tell you, hey, I've been here for 40 years. I've never flooded. And they're right. They haven't. But if you go back farther in time, you can see that building would have been inundated 7 times in history. So that's why it's important to know our deeper history. This gets into the psychology. I'm always concerned about a place that has not had a hit in 30, 40, 50 years or more. People typically get relaxed and think that they have low risk. Pensacola stands out as well, of 55 high water marks since the late 1800s. Again, I was surprised to see FEMA's base flood elevation. Their estimation for the 100-year storm was put at 7 feet. I thought there's no way they know the local history. You would never say that 7 feet is a 100-year storm. But keep in mind, the yellow line here covers 60 years of history from 1962 to now. Imagine if you lived there since 1962, you might say, well, maybe Ivan was like a million-year storm. You know, I've been here for 60 years. Ivan was an outlier. Everything else has been lower than my elevation of 7 feet. But if you know the deeper history, if you look at a deeper historical lens, it starts to look different. You see, wait, there wasn't one Ivan, there were three. There was also the 1906 and the 1926 storms. All three of those storms, including Ivan, pushed between 9 and 10 feet of salt water above sea level for the year of the storm. And so you can start to look at risk a little bit differently. I want to close with this last example from Galveston. This is the Galveston storm surge history since the late 1800s. I have a new graph to update with 98 high water marks. It's the most high water marks anywhere in the world. But you can see here the 1900 storm stands out. We also have the 1915 storm, Carla, Alicia, and Hurricane Ike in 2008. I have this mark put in here at a building. It's a very historic building called the George Manor. It was built in 1860. This graph only goes back to 1880, but the elevation of this building is around 10 feet of the first floor elevation. And this yellow line can go back twice as far. It was built in 1860. But imagine if you lived in this building for 40 years and it never flooded. You might think that you don't really have a big flood risk. And that's exactly what happened. Here's a picture of the George Manor on Market Street in Galveston. And I want to read to you, I want to close with this excerpt from a woman named Ida Smith Austin that lived in the George Manor when the 1900 storm hit. This is amazing, and I include this on my Galveston hurricane tour. This is a direct quote from her in her diary 2 months after the 1900 storm. She said, "I was busy about my domestic affairs Saturday, the day of the 1900 storm, rearranging my house, when I heard a man who ran up the street exclaim, 'My God, the waters of the bay and Gulf have met on 15th Street.' I went on the gallery to realize that what he said was only too true, but I felt no uneasiness and remarked to my niece, 'We have nothing to fear. The water has never been over our place.' And I just felt it could not come. In a few minutes, we heard the lapping of salt water against the sidewalk, and then it slowly crept into the yard. Bottom of the next paragraph, we opened all downstairs and let the water flow through. Soon it stood 3 feet in all the rooms. Again, we have nothing to fear. We've never flooded before." Well, that's true. They hadn't flooded in the 40 years up to the 1900 storm, but all of a sudden there's 3+ feet of water in their house. So this is the number one issue I face when I travel to coastal communities. People say, "I've lived here 30 years. We never flood. I don't need flood insurance. My neighborhood doesn't flood." We really need to look back deeper into history. And usually we see, my goodness, this house would have flooded 3 or 4 times in the past 120 years. So that's just getting into the psychology. It's common sense stuff, but it makes the case why we need to know our deeper storm surge history. A couple ways that you can follow me. I host a podcast on disasters, extreme weather, and resiliency. We have a new, it's like a radio show that airs every Monday. You can just do a web search for GeoTrek podcast. You can listen to it in your car. It's like a radio show. We learn a lot on this podcast and we cover a lot of topics. And also flood information systems. You can check this out. I'm building these historic data into FIS or flood information systems. And I also, the idea is to take these water levels and overlay them on, say, like a building inventory. This is Biloxi, Mississippi, where not only did we build the flood history, we built an inventory of building elevations. And so if a 16-foot surge happened in Biloxi, that's FEMA's base flood elevation, we said every building here in blue would flood. 73% of the buildings have water in them, and 6% of the buildings have at least 6 feet of water in them. So this idea to build your history, build your data-driven statistics, and then also build an inventory of the building elevations so you can get an idea, okay, if a flood does happen, what's the impacts? How many buildings is that going to flood? That's the heart behind FIS or flood information systems. I'd love to partner with your community, get local funding or a grant to build out these histories and these flood risk analysis as well. Everyone, thanks so much for taking time. Hey, the lawnmowers in the background got silent, and I hope you enjoyed the presentation. There's my phone number, my email, some of these websites, but hopefully we have time for a few questions. And I hope to see you in person next April at the National Tropical Weather Conference down in South Padre Island.
Wow.
Yeah.
Terrific stuff. Bill, let me thank the sponsors, and we'll get to the questions, because I know, Bill, you've got a lot. I've got a lot coming in online. So that's the sign of a great presentation, Hal. That was really good. I particularly love the timeline, the time series stuff, because that really tells a story. USAA, thanks to USAA for all that you do. We appreciate it. The South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau, the Weather Company, Black Magic Design, Weather Boy, Visit Brownsville, Walmart, and the Port of Brownsville, all sponsors that make this event a possibility. Bill, start it off, and then again, I've got some online questions to go as well.
Great. Wow. Excellent presentation, Al. I really like the nice detailed descriptions you have of the multiple factors that can affect storm surge. I think you correctly identified one of the problems is most people don't understand any of the issues that cause storm surge. I've been here almost 30 years, and every time I talk to someone here on the way up the bay, they feel a lot safer than they would on the island. And I show them these pictures that, well, the storm surge can be higher, much higher up here on the west side of Galveston Bay, the farther up the bay you go, than down on the island. It just won't have the wave action.
Bill, I analyzed all of the landfalling hurricanes from Galveston south along the Texas coast. All of them produced higher surge waters in the bay by an average of, I think, around 25% or 25 to 30%. So getting up by LaPorte, Baytown, where the refineries are, if you have a landfalling hurricane to the south of Galveston, you're going to get a higher surge in the bay. But interestingly, if the landfall was to the north and east of Galveston, like these Louisiana storms, then the higher surge is actually on the open coast. You don't really have a forcing mechanism to push the water into the bay. So right. Like Hurricane Laura, the storms that hit near the Texas-Louisiana border, the surge in that case will be higher out along the open coast.
Yeah, and the other thing is you have the strong north wind, so the bay water itself is lowering, being pushed out through the cuts. But the ones coming up towards us, we have the northeast and east winds, they end up with a sage-like effect and pile up the water on the bay side. I think that contributes to the higher levels up the bay than on the coast also. I'm really interested in the people part of the problem, and you talked about toward the end there. I found when I've talked to builders, even ones who build really good quality stuff, that they tend to downplay the risk of surge. Have you had any experience talking with builders along the coast?
Yeah, you know, we did this two-year project in Biloxi, and I would just assume people would know they're in a very vulnerable spot. I'm amazed, like, actually, the building code official in Biloxi said he gets pushback all the time. People saying, I was just in Florida, I was just in Sarasota, Florida, and we were eating on an open-air restaurant right by the water, and you're telling me here I can't do that? Like, what? There's always pushback. Why do we have to build so high? And so people really don't understand. Again, they look out at the water. The water looks the same to them. But a lot of times people just don't understand that their surge risk is so much higher than other places.
Yeah, I think being allowed to build in high-risk areas contributes to the problem. Someone moving from, let's say, Michigan down to the coast is not going to be as anywhere close to as familiar usually than people like you or I. And your basic thought is they wouldn't let you build a house where there's a high risk of it being wiped out by surge. So the buyers have even more of a lack of a sense of risk than the builders themselves.
Buyers come down and they feel like, hey, like the Pensacola example, if you build at 8 feet, you're above the required elevation. Someone moves down from Michigan, they've never been through a hurricane, they're not familiar with the area, they just assume that the models and the guidance is going to keep them out of harm's way. And so they may say, hey, I'm not in the flood zone, so I'm not going to flood, I don't need flood insurance. Or I am in the flood zone, but I'm above the required elevation, so I'm above the 100-year flood. I think a lot of times what we call the 100-year flood is more like the 30-year flood or the 40-year flood. So people think that they're building out of harm's way, and they're not.
Yeah, I lived in Jacksonville, Florida for a while, and that what you had pointed out there was resonated quite well. The general opinion of people I knew that were native of the area was that they were protected from hurricanes. And I'd say, how? And they kind of stumbled through that. They just said, well, we never had any problem with them. That's a serious denial issue of trying to prepare for something one has never experienced before, knowing that it's possible.
it's outside their frame of reference. And to some degree, there is a there is an element of truth in that. You will see more hurricane strikes down by Miami or on the Outer Banks of North Carolina than you will in that concave area. But historically, there have been strikes in there, and then the storm surges through the roof. So that's the issue for places like northeast Florida and Georgia.
Yeah. Tim, before we run out of time, I want to get to our viewer questions.
Yes, and out of the frame of reference, I think is an excellent. I love that phrase because it really speaks to a lot of people. Rob is asking a question out of Lafayette. He said it seems that I'm going to read it verbatim so I don't screw it up. It seems that the current in surges are the primary damaging determining factor, the currents and the surges, as seen in Sycamore Point in 2020. Large surge was higher while Delta surge was lower, but had more current and did more damage. Perhaps thanks to Laura scouring out more protective wetlands. What's your estimation of the speed of these more aggressive surge currents?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, surges, I did my best to show you some videos. It's hard to document this by video. Shout out to Mark Suddeth, who's going out there putting out cameras. You know, I'm driving around the best I can in my car, but once it gets bad enough, I can't be out there. But it's flowing in fast. I tried to show that somewhat with the videos, but all of these videos I showed you were low-end storms, or I'm on the periphery. So when you actually have the eyewall of a storm, the flow of this water can be incredible. The wave action, the scour, the currents, all of that can be incredible. And it's complex. I mean, it involves the bathymetry, the shape. Also, are the tides moving in or out at that time? So I think you could have two landfalling hurricanes in the same spot produce different conditions depending on has there been a lot of rain lately? Is the elevation of the bay up or down? I mean, all these things, it's quite complex. But I think what Rob is saying, the more current you have, the faster the velocity of the water, you're going to get a lot more action to cause destruction. And some of this, I think it's tough to model and it's tough to even observe. I've seen, though, that things can change very quickly and very localized as well.
Another high water question, then a historic question. So I'll start with a high water question from Casper. What about excessive rainfall and how does that contribute to the high water marks? And you've got a surge, but then excessive rainfall on top of that.
Yeah, you know, you could have a situation where you have a surge and then huge rainfall coming after that. Hurricane Florence comes to mind in 2018 in the Carolinas. You had a decent surge along the coast, but then it just parked. And then you have this tremendous rain. There is something called compound flooding where you get a prolonged onshore wind. When you get heavy rainfall, the rainfall is not going to drain that quickly when you have that surge rain combo. So that's something, even Harvey, Galveston Bay was up from you know, tropical storm force winds, and then you have all this rain trying to drain it. It's going to slow down the drainage rate of the rain. So that is something to think about. We call it compound flooding.
Peter's got a great historic question. Peter Black, you know, he's watching us from Peru today, and we appreciate you being here, Peter. He says, can you comment on how the accurate forecast of the Galveston hurricane by Reverend Benito Vinas from Havana, how that observation was ignored by U.S. Weather Bureau Director Willis Moore?
Yeah, great question. You know, this is right after the Spanish-American War. The U.S. had some issues, especially the forecasts were centralized, all coming out of D.C. Cuba has this tremendous history of observing and forecasting hurricanes. And you can kind of tell on the backside of a hurricane, you know, when you see these low-level cumulus clouds racing around the periphery, you can get an idea where their center was. Cuba thought that this storm has moved into the Gulf. The U.S. in general thought it's probably going up the East Coast. And so in a way, we didn't listen to the advice coming from the Cubans. And so I don't know if I want to say people let their guard down, but they really didn't know where this storm was. I think the Cubans indicated it's probably moving into the Gulf. I think that was downplayed by the U.S. Weather Bureau. But then all of a sudden, the rising water and the huge swells moving into Galveston the day before landfall started indicating something really unusual is happening out there in the Gulf.
Hal, I know you got to go. I'd like to do another hour on this. I've got a whole list of questions on my notepad here, and I'm sure Bill does as well, so we could go and go and go. But tremendous program today. Hal, thank you so much, and thank you for being part of NTWC Live, not just this week, but every week.
Thanks, Tim. A pleasure to be here. And again, tomorrow is the anniversary of the 1900 storm. We have some special things going on here in the city. You can go to Galveston Hurricane Tour to check out where we actually have an interactive educational thing in the evening. And you can, again, check out GeoTrek, flood information systems. These are all things we want to keep building. Reach out to me on email, by phone. The main thing is we want to keep partnering, expanding this, and working to help make your community more resilient. Thanks for the invite today, guys.
That's Hurricane Hal, ladies and gentlemen. Bill, any wrap-up thoughts? A last thought before we close it out, Bill?
Nope, it's always a sobering day when you live in Galveston County on the anniversary of the 1900 storm.
Amazing stuff. Gentlemen, thanks. Bill, thank you. Hal, thank you. Next week, our presentation is going to be Stephanie Murphy, who's the Vice President of Preparedness, Resiliency, and Emergency Management for Tidal Basin. That's next Wednesday at 10 a.m. That's going to be a great program as well. It's hard to top Hal. You hate to be the guy that follows Hal, but Stephanie's going to do a great job next week, we know as well. Once again, thanks to our sponsors, USAA, the South Padre Island Convention and Visitors Bureau, the Weather Company, Black Magic Design, Weather Boy, Visit Brownsville, Walmart, and the Port of Brownsville, all sponsors of this program. We will see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. and start making your plans for April 2023, South Padre Island for the National Tropical Weather Conference. Until next week, we'll see you. Thanks, guys.
Loved what you've heard on this week's episode? Well, the answer is simple. It would mean the world to us if you could head over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review and feedback. Spreading the word really is the best way to grow our podcast and achieve even greater things. Thank you.